Earlier this month, libertarian political scientist Charles Murray, author of The Bell Curve, which is derided by many as a racist take on the relationship between genetics and intelligence, was invited to speak at Middlebury College in Vermont.
I invite you to welcome with me.
We love
this evening's speaker, Dr. Charles Murray.
Murray only made it a couple of words into his talk when more than half of those crowding the hall stood up, turned their backs on him, and proceeded to read a long, prepared remark en masse.
What is most important must be spoken, made verbal and shared, even at the risk of having it bruised or misunderstood. Death is the final.
When Murray and the liberal professor who was to interview him after his talk were walking to the car, the crowds jostled him and injured her. Thus, with violence, liberal students curtailed the free speech rights of a visitor. The irony was not lost on the media. The ensuing torrent of editorials were focused on some familiar themes, namely trigger warnings, safe spaces, and political correctness on college campuses.
Today's college kids are so coddled, so protected, they're the equivalent of a 13-year-old from a century ago. Why give them freedom of any kind?
You're fighting for the right to be a pussy and not hear opinions that you don't like!
We dove into all of this last September after noticing a letter sent to incoming freshmen at the University of Chicago, which read, quote, "We do not support so-called trigger warnings. We do not cancel invited speakers because their topics might prove controversial, and we do not condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces where individuals can retreat from ideas and perspectives at odds with their own." So, is free expression on college campuses being stifled by tools like trigger warnings and safe spaces? Cameron Okeke graduated from the University of Chicago in 2015. He wrote a piece last fall for Vox titled, "I'm a Black UChicago Graduate. Safe Spaces Got Me Through College." As the title suggests, he wrote in response to that welcome letter to his alma mater's incoming class.
I was upset when I first read it. My time at the University of Chicago, I hadn't really encountered places where I could run away from people's perspectives. But I could find places where people didn't question who I was. And I thought that's a very different type of safe space. And so that kind of led me to write the piece.
So let's talk about the unsafe environment that the safe space provides a sanctuary from.
So the University of Chicago has been under Title IX investigation for a while now. There has been task force, dialogue after dialogue, but the fact still remains there's been a long history of ignoring marginalized populations. There has been racist parties. There have been incidents of racist costumes. There have been the creation of this place called the New Chicago Politically Incorrect, which included a plethora of hateful, threatening, disdainful speech about students, like personally attacking students. And that doesn't even speak to the amount of sexual assault mishandlings that have happened over the last couple years. And so the climate is one in which if you're a person of color or if you are a woman or if basically if you're a person who doesn't have a privileged identity, you don't have the type of institutional support or backing that other students may have.
Now, you found a safe space, which turned out to be the Office of Multicultural Affairs.
Mm-hmm. And when I was there, you know, it wasn't that I wasn't challenged and no one would take my ideas and kind of run them through the intellectual ringer, but I was never being pestered by other students to explain what it means to be Black or being tested in such a way to see if I'm actually fit the UChicago
profile.
Profile, yes.
You didn't fit the profile?
Not at all. I mean, I was a first-generation student born in the South Side of Chicago, and I'm Black. So it was one of those situations where people were like, oh, what are you doing here? Is it affirmative action? I can't tell you how many questions I fielded about Black culture, about why Black people don't value education, why is the South Side of Chicago dangerous, blah, 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 blah. And in OMSA, if they want to answer these questions, they would ask them in a respectful manner. They didn't assume or demand an answer from me as if I was only there to be the diversity for them. They cared about me as a person. And I think that having that type of space made me more willing to offer up my perspective and actually exercise my speech.
You've made the point that trigger warnings and safe spaces actually are conducive to academic freedom.
We have seen time and time again that diversity for diversity's sake is not enough. We can't just have people of color in a room. We can't just have women in a room and expect them to speak. Freedom of speech is not something that has ever been equally accessible in our nation. We have to do work for that. And I think that part of what trigger warnings and safe spaces do, they do the work to give people a way to step away from the conversation so they can reenter it when they feel like they can. And it gives people the freedom to engage when they need to and then also step away when they can't. And I think that that enriches the conversation as opposed to undermining it, because it just doesn't work trying to force people into a conversation that they don't want to have.
Critics call that coddling. Your generation is just so sensitive.
We are sensitive. I honestly think that the critics who claim that we can't take the realness of the real world don't seem to understand that being born Black, being born a woman, being born whatever way you are that doesn't fit into the mainstream norm means your life is already hard. I was already living in the real world before I came to the University of Chicago. And I don't ask my university to coddle me any more than I guess any other student would ask them to accommodate their needs, especially given the fact that universities have spent the larger part of their history catering to and pandering to one demographic of people. And so I think that there is a certain degree in which we should be able to ask for the university to change the way it functions to accommodate the diversity it claims that it wants.
You have to assume that the U of Chicago sent this letter because administrators think that there is a stifling of expression and that it's part of a nationwide trend. Mm-hmm. Do you see that happening?
I see it happening, but I don't see it happening because of the trigger warnings or because of safe spaces. We are living in what I think would be an unprecedented political climate. But the university shouldn't use this in their welcoming letter. If they want to have a conversation about this, fine. That'd be great. But a welcoming letter for new high school graduates who are excited to be in this type of intellectually stimulating, amazing environment is not the time to tell them what you do and don't condone. It's a time to welcome them and say that we as a university, we support diversity, we care about people, we're doing our best. That's what a welcome letter should do. They tried to curb the trend, but they didn't do anything else but fan the flames.
Cameron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cameron Okeke graduated from the University of Chicago in 2015. He's currently earning a master's in bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. His recent piece in Vox is called "I'm a Black U Chicago Graduate. Safe Spaces Got Me Through College." Okeke argues that trigger warnings can help students find their voice in a classroom. That's why Cornell philosophy prof Kate Mann uses them.
A trigger warning is, for me, as simple as a one-sentence heads up in an email to students saying this week's reading contains maybe a graphic description of a sexual assault or a description of active military combat, something along those lines. And I should add, I teach feminist philosophy, so a lot of the material that I cover is on misogyny and topics like mass rape during genocide. So a lot of people who teach wouldn't have any reason to use them, allowing students who have the relevant sensitivities to prepare themselves for those sorts of discussions.
You expect in a class of 200 there might be some traumatized people in there. Maybe they shouldn't be taking that class.
The current evidence suggests that perhaps as many as 1 in 5 students will be sexually assaulted while on campus. So we would be potentially ruling out a lot of people from discussions of sexual assault who might have the most reason to engage in them if they didn't feel comfortable coming into class ready to confront these harrowing topics. People have real bodies, real memories, real histories. People don't come into university necessarily shiny and new. Not everyone is able to dive into every topic with complete equanimity. But that doesn't mean we can't talk about it. We have to.
And you haven't noticed people skipping out from your classes with a note from their doctor?
No, that just hasn't come up. The key really is to think about trigger warnings as preparation for people to engage rationally, calmly, and fully with the material. They're not designed to foster avoidance. The people who I happen to know in my classes have had the relevant traumatic experiences, sometimes recently, will often thank me not just for providing trigger warnings, but for bringing up subjects that they want discussed because they've been there.
Obviously, you've heard the opponents of trigger warnings suggest that this is just more coddling for a generation that's already been coddled practically into paralysis. I just wonder whether by saying, take care over this section you're going to do. You're putting red lines and exclamation points. You're just give a reason for students to be censorious.
I mean, the reason I give trigger warnings is I'm teaching material that traditionally people have been protected from in the academy. There is very little discussion, say, of misogyny and sexual assault in philosophy until feminist philosophers began to introduce those topics. So it's not obvious to me that this is really about coddling so much as that's an expression of resentment to extending basic consideration and kindness to people when, in fact, new and more challenging topics are under discussion.
The weird thing is that the banner of academic freedom has been picked up by both sides of this discussion.
Yeah.
What I see is the creation of an environment where it is the professors that are being curtailed in their speech.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people who historically have been very privileged are feeling unfree because members of historically subordinated groups are freer to morally criticize their statements.
Professors want to be safe, too.
Yeah, I think there's a fair amount of wanting to be coddled from moral criticisms that hurt, but that's what we have to learn to do. We have to learn to sometimes think, you know what, I put that badly. I feel ashamed. Now I have to pick my head up, apologize, and keep teaching.
Can you see a scenario in which trigger warnings could narrow academic freedom?
Yeah. I mean, I think we have to be very careful about the possibility of trigger warnings becoming mandatory and it being top down on the part of the administration. That would clearly infringe on academic freedom, and I would be the first to be up in arms about it. What I am in favor of is student-led, bottom-up requests for trigger warnings.
You want the kids to run the university?
I want my students, personally, to be comfortable challenging me, and I think that's hard. I know how hard it is to challenge authority figures of any kind, and I do want students to be able, in a respectful, civil way, to say, actually, that was a really problematic way to approach this material, because that's what it means to have an egalitarian approach to education.
And is that automatically a good thing?
There's certainly differences in expertise. I'm not saying that I don't have intellectual authority in lots of ways in the classroom because that's why I'm there. But there's a difference between intellectual authority and moral authority. And in some ways, students of mine who are not white, say, will have moral and political authority with respect to issues of race, and I should be listening.
Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Kate Mann teaches philosophy at Cornell. Jeffrey Stone is a professor of law at the University of Chicago, where he specializes in the First Amendment. He helped stake out the university's position on free speech and said that that letter sent to freshmen that sparked the whole debate had been widely misinterpreted. When we spoke to him last fall, he told us that the university is fine with both trigger warnings and safe spaces, as long as the former isn't mandatory or the latter exclusive.
The letter, which was written by the dean of students in the college, was basically meant to suggest that trigger warnings and safe spaces are both problematic concepts in an institution committed to academic freedom and to a robust political discourse. I think they've been misconstrued as suggesting that trigger warnings should be prohibited, even if faculty members wish to offer them, and that the idea of safe spaces, which is a very ambiguous term, in general is inappropriate, which is not at all what the letter said.
Yeah, that's sure not what he said, though. He said, we don't support trigger warnings. We don't condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces. So condone means the college is withholding its blessing from the creation of these safe spaces and that they don't support trigger warnings.
It's saying it doesn't encourage them, but it's up to the individual faculty member. It's a short letter addressed to entering students. It was not meant to be this huge public issue. As I've said before, I think this is much ado about nothing. I don't in any way begrudge the discussion of these kinds of questions. Having discussions about trigger warnings and about safe spaces and about certainly academic freedom, those are great issues. But coming back over and over again to the letter, which is written by a dean of students, not by the university president, not by a faculty committee, is just taking it way out of proportion.
You've written about how freedom of expression in American universities has kind of seesawed for centuries. Could you give us a brief history?
Sure. In the early 19th century and before that, universities were places in which the leaders of the institution would dictate, based on a principle of doctrinal moralism, what ideas could and could not be expressed. During the 1820s and 30s and 40s, during the debates over slavery, there were faculty members and students in the North who were disciplined or fired because of their defense of slavery, and there were faculty members in the South who were fired because of their criticism of slavery. It was during the era of Darwin and the dispute over creationism that universities, for the first time, began to talk seriously about freedom of expression, the quest for truth, and not to be bound by conventional wisdom. But even then, the issues continued to roil. During World War I, universities disciplined students and faculty members who raised questions about the legitimacy of the war. During the McCarthy era, of course, universities across the country basically banned any student or faculty member who was seen in any way as sympathetic to communism. During the Vietnam era, there were strong disputes about the appropriateness of dissent on campuses. So this has been an ongoing issue from all of our history. But increasingly over time, universities have come to accept the principle that for them to meet their responsibilities, faculty and students alike need to be able to express their views without having some senior officials determining what ideas are or are not permissible.
So how would you characterize the state of academic freedom now?
Well, I would say that once again, it is under serious challenge. It's different from many of the prior episodes. Historically, the students were always the champions of academic freedom and of their own free speech. In this instance, ironically, it is the students who are the primary forces calling for censorship. The other difference is that traditionally it tended to be political conservatives who favored censorship. And now, interestingly, it's political conservatives who are robustly defending the freedom of speech. Liberals have always been the champions of free speech, both nationally and in universities, are divided. There are the sort of traditional liberals, like myself, who strongly believe in academic freedom. And there are others who basically say, well, even more important than free speech and academic freedom is ensuring that individuals who feel marginalized or alienated are protected from that environment, and therefore free speech should be confined.
This week we spoke to a UChicago grad who sees trigger warnings and safe spaces as essential to creating a campus climate in which all people feel free to express themselves.
Well, the key meaning of a safe space is that students can get together with other students with similar backgrounds and experiences and share their experiences with one another, learn from one another, feel safe in their conversations with each other, make plans, invite speakers. All colleges and universities have endless student organizations supported by the universities designed to enable them to do that. That's what, in my view, a safe space should be understood to be.
And Cameron Okeke, the University of Chicago grad that we spoke to, said that the safe space for him was the multicultural center, where people of all different backgrounds got together without having to be the representative of a community that the majority of students wouldn't likely encounter. In other words, a place where they could have a freer expression without constantly trying to justify their own presence.
Sure, and that's a good idea, and they exist all over the place.
And that's all he's supporting, and maybe this is just an argument over definitions?
That's partly what I've been trying to say, is if safe space means a physical location that is earmarked only for people of a certain background, and only people of that background are allowed to enter some particular permanent space, that's a different issue. The reality is it's critical for students to have an opportunity to congregate with other students with similar experiences and to work things out themselves. And that exists all over universities, as it should.
But you do think that academic freedom is under threat?
The issues about academic freedom are about canceling speakers, intimidating students and faculty from saying things, demanding that the university punish students for saying things that other students don't like. That's the threat. It's not about trigger warnings, frankly, and safe spaces. It's about the effort to exclude from universities the expression of ideas that some students disagree with. That's the threat to academic freedom. And it is as serious a threat as we've seen in the last 40 years. And social media, by the way, makes it far worse than it ever was before. Because it used to be that if a faculty member or a student said something that was controversial, you could have an argument, you could have a debate, you can say things that, you know, were provocative. Today, those statements wind up on social media, and for the rest of your life, people can find it, look it up, and take it out of context. And we're seeing real chilling effect on the willingness of students and faculty to speak openly, to speak candidly, to speak courageously. That's not a healthy thing for academic freedom.
Can you give an example so that listeners will know the sort of thing you're talking about?
At one college, a group of students chalked on the sidewalk Trump in 2016. And other students demanded that the students who had done that be disciplined because the message Trump in 2016 made them feel unsafe. At another institution, indeed at many institutions, students learning that a particular speaker had been invited to the campus insisted that the university withdraw the invitation, and to avoid controversy, the university acquiesced. In other situations, a speaker comes to campus and students and others disrupt the event, yelling and screaming and so on, to the point where the event is canceled. Those are just common occurrences these days, and they're not consistent with what universities should aspire to.
The president of the Evergreen State College, George Bridges, wrote in the Seattle Times this week, "Colleges and universities must change as the society changes, and unlike 10 to 20 years ago, schools must now acknowledge and address issues that they have largely ignored in the past: sexual violence on campus, its effect on student victims, the impact of war experiences on veterans returning to college, and what's more, there's a real effort by colleges to recruit more diverse student populations, people who weren't there before, low-income students, people of color, people with disabilities, transgender people. These are new times that may call for new measures."
I agree completely with that, but it does not call for censorship. The mission of a university is to empower students, to make them effective, to teach them how to address things that are offensive and problematic and challenging so they can persuade other people that they are right. The mission of a university is not to shield students, because the world will not shield them.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Jeffrey Stone is professor of law at the University of Chicago, where he specializes in the First Amendment. Thanks for listening to this On the Media Podcast Extra. Just a quick reminder, we have a weekly newsletter that you have to sign up for. It's funny and informative, and sometimes we have giveaways, so go to onthemedia.org to subscribe. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.